Imogen, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, very well, thanks.
So, Imogen, what do the laws regarding Sydney University's college independence mean in terms of how they operate and how that relates back to the university?
Yeah, so there are, you know, six colleges at the university, all the very fancy ones, St. Paul's, St. John's, all of those. They're all founded on this state legislation, which dates back over 100 years. And it gives them a whole heap of autonomy over how they operate and how they conduct their affairs. They're quite short acts of parliament, but they cover, you know, constitution, makeup, councils, elections, the duties of their office holders. But how it plays out is it leads to these really entrenched cultures that are remarkably difficult to shift. You know, they're powerful institutions. They're able to be shielded from scrutiny as a result of their autonomy, and they're willing to protect their reputations and traditions at all costs. How it plays out for survivors of sexual assault on campus, often what it means is that this, like, rape and hazing and abuse go completely unpunished. There's a whole, you know, there's a whole litany of abuses within the college system, but some of the ones that might hit listeners' minds are around the St. Paul's defined statutory pro-rape anti-consent Facebook page. And despite having a whole list of all the students involved in the creation of that page, as the college is a separate legal entity, the university never investigated the incident. And that sort of model of, you know, the separate legal status being able to shield perpetrators and shield people who are making a campus an unsafe place keeps going on and on and on, and can be that incident, that model can be brought to so many other experiences of women on campus as well.
Well, why were these laws even created in the first place?
They're very, very old institutions. So St. Paul's Act dates back to 1854, which is only a couple of years after the University of Sydney was created. So I think a whole heap of it is just how sort of insanely anachronistic these institutions are. But fundamentally, it's about ensuring freedom from religious interference, which has led to this culture of sort of militant entitlement and bullying. And they've just proven themselves that they've lost their social license to operate. They've time and time again proven to be these islands of impunity that operate under separate standards and laws to the rest of the university and the broader community.
Now, the results of the investigation by former Sex Discrimination Commissioner Elizabeth Broderick, into five of Sydney University's six campus colleges, it was pretty jarring, with up to a third of the women at these colleges experiencing sexual harassment. How do you think New South Wales Labor's pledge could potentially help change this?
Yeah, well, I tend to think that colleges are a stain on campus. So any sort of progressive attempts in order to reduce their autonomy, it is a positive step forward. And I don't think it's a college that can reform itself. It's incredibly resistant to attempts from outsiders to reform it, which is why these soft interventions that we've had over the years have completely failed. Because, you know, there's social power and influence at play. They gain great benefit from the status quo and a continuation of these traditions that cement their place as an essential part of the college experience. So I think this intervention is a great thing. I'm sure that it's sending absolute shivers down the spines of college and university administrations, and I think is a really strong campaign point to push for a change to that culture. I've got a copy of the motion in front of me, and I think it's quite interesting that recommendation one, which was about stripping the acts and the autonomy so they fall under the university, I think it was actually rejected. And what was noted by New South Wales Labor is that they welcome the opportunity to work with the university colleges to modernise its governance arrangements. And this follows on from a lot of the work of what Joe Halen, the member of Summer Hill, has been doing with St. John's College. And it's sort of less so really about, in my opinion, stripping that sort of insider-outsider, really deep-rooted sexist culture within the colleges, but it's about providing a bit of a shake-up of the college council, decreasing the amount of clergy influence. But there's a whole heap of distorted culture within these accommodations doesn't necessarily just come from the top bottom, from the clergy on the council. And I think we really need to sort of look beyond just reducing its autonomy or looking into ways we can shake up its administration, and really need to be fighting against sexual assault in the communities from a prevention basis and, in my opinion, looking at a way we can end the college system.
If you've just tuned into The Daily this morning, we're here with Imogen Grant, the president of the SRC at the University of Sydney. Is with us to talk about New South Wales Labor's plan to scrap laws that allow Sydney University colleges to operate outside of the university's control. So, Imogen, you're talking about the dangerous hazing rituals and sexual assault. It's a culture at these college campuses. What's allowed this culture to thrive at the college campuses?
Yeah, I think at first it's critical to understand the elite nature of the colleges. A first-year room at Paul's will set a student back about $30,000, which is roughly three times the price of a room in an average in a West Share house. They have their rooms cleaned for them, their meals prepared for them. At Women's College, they have hand-picked wines to complement their dinners. So not only is there these sort of real power dynamics that play around elitism, it also intertwines and dovetails with the really deep-rooted sexist culture. They're often dominated by a clique of socially powerful older students who acquire leadership positions within the college community. And this creates an atmosphere where these older students can abuse and exploit younger students. On hazing, it normalizes a culture whereby people's personal boundaries and consents are ritually violated, and contributes to a culture whereby students feel as though they're entitled, that they can, you know, entitled to the bodies of those in more marginal positions, be them men to women. There's a whole heap of homophobia that also exists within the college system as well, and racism, which has been documented at the University of Sydney. And people who attempt to speak out against this abuse, they're often ostracised and face sort of really harsh repercussions socially within the college community as well.
If these laws are scrapped, what is the next step?
Well, at the University of Sydney and nationally, there's been a really great campaign around sexual assault and around making sure that universities own up to their responsibility to address sexual assault through primary prevention, but also trauma-informed services and pathways for reporting. I really think that campaign is absolutely inspiring. It's really taking some enormous strides, which has led us to where we are today. I don't think it's just an issue of who manages the culture, who manages the colleges. I think what we've seen is that these are places that have enabled rampant abuse and sexism, and they've lost their social license to operate, in my opinion. I believe, as I said before, that colleges are a stain on campus rather than bringing opportunities for campus-wide participation into social life. They're sort of individually and collectively, they're bastions of elitism and sexism and homophobia and parochialism and almost sort of, you know, mind-numbing anti-intellectualism. And of course, there are shining examples of college students who embrace university life and are well-rounded. But in my experience, colleges cling on to these examples to excuse the vomiting, the rape, and all of the other sordid things that happen within the college system. And I think we need to think about what would an ideal accommodation system look like at the university? One where that sort of minor string of benefits of attending college, around the collegiality, around the community, can actually be, you know, are actually achievable for all students, irregardless of their own or their parents' income. And I think when we start to think about that, so what would an ideal accommodation system look like? One that's safe, one that's affordable. I think it's quite clear that colleges don't have a place in such a vision for the university.
That's all the time we've got for this morning. Thank you so much for joining us, Imogen.
Yeah, no worries. Have a great day.
You too. Thank you.